The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
So Budapest is generally not a Fidesz supporter. I dare to say there's not even going to be an opposition candidate next year to run for mayor in Budapest. So Fidesz is not only going to win, but even going to win without a fight. I don't have an answer for that. I do see that there are some parties that are trolls, that are actually, you know, fake parties funded by Fidesz to prevent a coalition of opposition parties. But it's the same. It's, you know, my research institute is going to be shut down. It's a public institution. I'm not doing anything. I've written a book on Orban, but I'm also incapacitated somehow, psychologically, mentally, emotionally, to do anything. There's no unions. We're not doing anything. We're just there as a game, and in front of a hunter's gun, and we know that the gun is pointed at us, and we're not doing anything.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 23rd, 2018. Last week, while traveling in the United Kingdom, I met up with András Papp, a Hungarian scholar of constitutional law. Papp is a professor with Central European University's Nationalist Studies program in Budapest, and we had over breakfast a long chat about the decline of Hungarian democracy. We talked about the Fidesz party. We talked about Hungary's strongman ruler, Viktor Orban. We talked about to what extent Hungary is similar to and different from other European countries. We talked about why András Papp was cheerfully having breakfast with me, talking about all these things and not fearing what would happen to him when he returns to Budapest. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 358, András Papp on Viktor Orban and the decline of Hungarian democracy.
Start by telling us about yourself, who you are, what you do.
Good morning. My name is András Papp, and I'm a constitutional lawyer. I do comparative constitutional law, and generally I live and work in Hungary. I have, this is going to be a long list of what I do, but that's I guess we're already in the middle of what Central Europe and what Hungary is about. So, you know, I am one of the many academics who will not have one answer to where do you work. So I have several and multiple affiliations. I've been teaching at Central European University's Nationalism Studies program for about 15 years. I also work as a researcher at the Hungarian Academy of Sciences. This public body has a web of research institutes. I work at the Institute for Legal Studies. I also teach at ELTE and also the National Public Service University's Law Enforcement Faculty. So I teach at various places. I also, until the end of this year, I am a Marie Curie Fellow at the Slovak Academy of Sciences. So this is the long list of my current affiliations. I'm generally, besides having a duty to write and comment on, you know, what happens in politics and constitutional law, and I've been doing a lot of human rights reporting. I've also been working with NGOs, with human rights NGOs in the region in Hungary. I'm a member of the Hungarian Helsinki Committee, but my actual research interest is in how law operationalizes race and ethnicity. So I've been, my core academic work has been on minority rights and issues and discrimination, hate crimes, and those kind of.
Hungary is a weird case right now, and let's start with a kind of overview of the changes in the Hungarian political system over the last few years. It's kind of held out often as the most advanced example of a deconsolidating or deconsolidated democracy. On the other hand, it's still sitting there in the EU, and people like you are free to come to conferences in England and record podcasts criticizing Viktor Orban, the head of government. So how would you, in your own words, how would you describe the Hungarian political system today?
I mean, Hungary is an odd case. I mean, the more I think about it and talk about it, and especially in the light of recent developments, and by recent I mean the past couple of months since the third election that Orban has won in the spring. I think so. I think, you know, Hungary was an interesting comparison, and you could pair it up with developments in Poland and, you know, Brexit and Trump and all that. But now, I mean, I think the oddnesses has gotten to a new level. I think now, you know, whatever you look at, Hungary is off the scale. So I actually now have difficulties, you know, putting Hungary in the clusters that, you know, even a few months ago I was somewhat comfortable moving around. I mean, you know, in a way, of course, what happens in Hungary would characterize Hungary as one of, you know, the plethora of classifications and definitions. So Hungary is certainly a hybrid regime in a sense that, you know, one way it shows all the signs of an authoritarian, non-democratic, so this whole sort of, you know, illiberal democracy discourse. So it's you know, so in one way you see that, but in other ways it's still not Russia, it's still not North Korea, it's still not, I don't know, Kazakhstan or...
So walk us through both of those points. What is the sense in which it is an authoritarian strongman regime? What makes Viktor Orban different from Angela Merkel or Emmanuel Macron?
I mean, it really has been an interesting experience for me. I mean, first of all, so what happened in the first... So, you know, Orban came into power in 2010. So it's been more than 8 years now. So, you know, what happened in the first 4 to 8 years is the classic dismantling of checks and balances and, you know, the things we teach at the first constitutional law class and how important this is, separation of power, how important it is to have independent powerhouses or sources of political power. This has been, I mean, this has been very widely documented, how this has been dismantled very systematically, very swiftly, you know, very soon after a landslide political victory in 2010, which gave Orban a two-thirds majority, which allowed his party coalition to amend the constitution and even adopt a new one. So, you know, we see the classic recipe of how to dismantle a pre-existing, you know, constitutional checks and balances system. Court packing, you raise the number of members of the Constitutional Court, if you have one, and Hungary has had one, it has been amongst the most, you know, one of the most powerful, or very powerful constitutional courts, have been a very important player in the democratization of Hungary and the former sort of development of the constitutional order in Hungary. So what you do, you raise the number of the judges, you obviously elect your people, you even raise the term limits for justices. So you cement, you know, your people and your ideologists and your followers in that system. You weaken the non-constitutional sort of court system by, early retirement laws and, you know, basically changing the staffs, you know, bringing in new people who would be, again, your supporters, limiting the activity, curtailing and controlling the activity of parliament, of the opposition in parliament by, you know, all sorts of means and a very strong-handed, speaker. So, you know, you do everything. You do gerrymandering, you adopt a new citizenship law with a very carefully targeted and tailored, you know, target community will be, so, you know, bringing in a large number of new voters. You know, so you do everything you need to do. So that has been done in the first Well, actually, very fast. Like in the first couple of months, I mean, they've adopted, you know, you would have constitutional amendments going through, of course, submitted through individual members of parliament. So, you know, avoiding, you know, public debates, etc. So you would have constitutional amendments going through in parliament in a day or, you know, in 2 days. A brand new constitution was adopted in a couple of months without any public, you know, debate, or even, of course, this was never part of the political program with which, you know, Orban's party ran in 2010. So, you know, this has been done in the first 4 years. The second 4 years were basically building up an extremely, I mean, an extremely corrupt regime. I mean, we have to say that the Hungarian economy to a very large degree runs on EU structural funds, development funds, so, and a bunch of other investments. So Hungary has a, you know, flood of money coming in, and this has been, and it's been widely and openly documented. This has been, you know, the structure corruption has been sort of, you know, has, you know, this, a system of how this money can be taken for the, you know, to the, and transfer to the prime minister's friends and, you know, family and a very close circle of Orban's political allies. This is pretty much, if we want to simplify, this is what has happened in the second parliamentary cycle that Orban has won. By the way, I mean, Orban has actually lost by one mandate, a 2/3 majority in his second term. But, you know, by then everything was, you know, cemented. The regime operated swiftly, so there was no need for that. And now in this year, Orban again got a 2/3 majority. Not that, again, he needed it very, you know, very much. Now what we see is a new era, whereas the first, again, so the first 4 years were about structural, political, institutional building up of this illiberal regime. The second, you know, again, if we're simplifying, was about, you know, building up the channels of how to get money, you know, how to channel money into private or the newly emerging oligarchs' bank accounts. And now the third stage is actually, I don't know where it's going to end, but it has been pretty much formally said that this is not going to be about culture. It's going to be, this is the first time we're actually, individuals, institutions are being targeted. So, you know, theaters, you know, Billy Elliot, just to give you a few examples, the show of Billy Elliot has been basically, through political pressure, has been removed from the program of the Opera House because it's a propagation of homosexuality. We have universities shut down. We have university programs shut down. The government, as of today, have prohibited the accreditation, has ended the accreditation of gender studies. So again, this is a reflection of these debates on gender ideology and how this is a, we see, you know, academic, it's mostly, again, it doesn't concern a large number of people. It concerns academics and intellectuals. So we have, you know, academic institutions are going to be closed down. I mean, public institutions. We have a major university with a government decree given to a private foundation, which is obviously friends and political allies of Orban. So we actually see now an actual entrenchment on, and again, I don't know where this is going to stop, on individual, you know, civil liberties and human rights. So, after the first stage of focusing on institutional issues, now I think we're getting on to, and of course the promise was that the new constitution have had clauses that would provide for the curtailment and the, you know, of lots of civil liberties, but that has never been done. So for example, the constitution has a provision on basically prohibiting and outlawing homelessness. And just as of this week, as of this Monday, a new law came into force, which actually now specifies this. And by the way, it's a very humane piece of legislation. It even allows the police not only to arrest homeless, I don't know where you're going to take these people. I mean, it practically can be prison. So not only are they allowed to arrest people, you know, who live on the streets, but they also, without any due process, without anything, can actually burn their belongings. So family pictures and things like that. So this is to show how, you know, humane the regime is. So again, this was already foreseen in the constitution, but it took another, I don't know, 6 to 8 years to actually come into play. So this is the authoritarian part. Now, the other part.
Before you get to the other part, I want to flesh out two elements of the authoritarian part. One of the things that makes Hungary different from other countries is a high degree of media consolidation in government hands or the hands of people who are effectively tools of or arms of Viktor Orban. Talk about the information environment. If you are only a Hungarian speaker, what does your news and information look like?
Yeah, that's a very important aspect. I mean, in post-communist countries, political control over public media has always been an important issue. This has happened everywhere in the region. This is what Hungarian media wars were about in the 1990s. Who gets to appoint leaders of public media and all that? Of course, that was before the explosion of the internet and all that. What the important thing with Hungary is it's not only public media, it's also commercial and private media. So practically, if you live outside Budapest, which is, Hungary has a population of 10 million people, about 2 million live in the capital city, the rest. So if you live outside Budapest, practically, especially if you live in the countryside, like small towns or villages, the only media you will have access to practically, and by that I mean electronic media in a sense of, TV, radio, and print media that will either be free, the semi-tabloid, or whatever is accessible, will be blatant government propaganda. So we will not have, there is no print opposition or independent print media practically available outside. There are two very smallly circulated, a weekly and a daily, very, very few. So practically, it's government propaganda is flooded on you from public television and also a large number of commercial TV channels and radio, which would be even the, music radio would be having the news, the propaganda news taken from the national news agency. That's an important factor.
And when you say blatant government propaganda, what's the content? What are the big theme messages of the messaging that people are getting?
Basically, the most important message is, there would be a couple of buzzwords that now in the past, most important buzzword is immigration, which is, Hungary is the classic case for it. What they used to say about, Jews and anti-Semitism, that you don't actually need Jews to have Jews for anti-Semitism. You don't actually need to have refugees or asylum seekers or migrants in Hungary. Hungary is a country with, Hungary has always had a very harsh, but since, Orban's in power, an extremely harsh non-recognition, policy for recognizing, refugees. And, after the refugee crisis in 2015, which was basically a media hack, I could say, so practically no migrants. No one really comes to Hungary. Hungary is an ethnic, it's 100%, apart from a genuine, very long, coexisting ethnic minority. The Roma, Hungary is, 100% ethnically homogeneous. Very, very few immigrants. Tiny, Chinese and Vietnamese immigrant communities. It's a political transition. So everybody's Hungarian. There no one comes to Hungary. I mean, once you have access to the EU, why would you stay in Hungary? A language very difficult to learn. A society not very inclusive. So, so Hungary does not have a migrant population. So anyway, immigration, of course, washing together the concept of refugee and migrants, asylum seeker, migrants. So it's refugees, and George Soros, who would be the devil incarnate. So we'd have massive, large billboards all over the country with the face of Soros. Now, Sargentini as well, after the report on Hungary in the European Parliament, and there's also going to be new billboards coming up. I haven't seen them yet. So the messages are extremely clear. It's migration and Soros. Just a week ago, on Facebook, they circulated. I think it's very telling. Someone did a video, a 1 minute compilation of the main public, the national TVs, so public TVs, evening news, which is, I think, 30 minutes or something, compilation in 1 minute, how many, and it was basically a repetition of migration, and Soros. And for 1 minute, you actually hear that. So we hear it 150 times. And that's exactly from a 30 minute news, evening news program. So that would pretty much be the message. The general message is Hungary is attacked. We are on our own. We're doing it our way. And the entire world, just perfectly clear, the entire world's against us. And yet this is our way to go. And it's for, and of course we're threatened by migration, immigration. And so, but again, what we have to see that this is not only the public media, because if you were living in a consolidated market economy democracy, you wouldn't, okay, public media is whatever owned by the government, but you have all sorts of independence. So, and it's gone. I mean, there's no, because of the, I would also say the level of economic, you know, corruption. So there was a very large independent news outlet. It was called Nep Sabatjeg. It has been the successor of the largest, you know, communist newspaper. That has been, I mean, it has had for many years, you know, hundreds of thousands of readers. I mean, it was the, whatever, the New York Times. And it went bankrupt. I mean, there's not even an economic, you know, there's no market support, there's, you know, for an independent, you know, print media. I mean, of course, that's, you know, came at a wrong, you know, I guess the internet doesn't have that and all that. So what we have to see that an average Hungarian voter, especially who does not live in the capital, will not have access. I mean, they could, you could go, and there is a major independent website that, you know, actually has lots and lots of readers. But even this is in the actually owned by Orbán's circle, and you know it's a question of time when it will be shut down or transformed into government propaganda organs, government propaganda organs. So that's again, I have to stress again that it's all media that one would have access to.
So when Orbán's political party Fidesz was founded, I remember thinking of it as a kind of traditional Reaganite conservative party, sort of Thatcher Reagan in Central Europe, a sort of post-communist. And it now represents some kind of kleptocratic nationalism. Talk about that ideological transformation. How did Viktor Orban go from being a kind of young, conservative post-communist politician to being a authoritarian figure?
I would actually go you know, one step back. Orban actually started out as a liberal. In 1988, when Fidesz was founded, it was a liberal party. And by liberal, we mean not, it is, you know, in Eastern Europe, these are not economic policy and social policy commitments, but we're talking about politics. So, you know, human rights and sort of, yeah. So Fidesz was a liberal party. I think the peculiarities of the political transition in Hungary was that, which again, looking back is not self-explanatory, that the strongest opposition, the second strongest party around the political transition was a liberal party, which now has completely disappeared. It doesn't even exist legally anymore. And Fidesz was seen as a sort of a young, you know, a children chapter of the big liberal party. So in the first few years before the election of the new parliament, and also in the first parliament, so like Fidesz was a liberal party. Orbán was the young liberal Hungarian whose promise was, who has made this exceptional promise that he said that this, his generation is going to end this, you know, century-long intellectual clash between two camps, the cosmopolitan urban liberals and the conservatives, so very much echoing the Russian sort of the Narodnik and the urbans and the rurals, or the folkish, the conservative nationalist sort of divide is going to end, and his party and his, you know, they are going to bring an end to this, and you know, going to have a progressive New Europe. So that was his promise in 1990. Which was a remarkable revolutionary progressive thought. He basically writes that his party does not have, you know, would be in a political vacuum, you know, being another liberal party, you know, no one needs two liberal parties, especially not in Central Europe. So he has made a conservative turn. He realized that his personal charisma will enable him to be the unifying leader of the moderate conservative right wing. But again, these people, I mean, we have to say that Fidesz was founded by a group of people who were roommates in dormitories of the law school in the late 1980s. They have these people, so who are the core of this party, have never had a job other than being members of parliament. So Orban was his early 20s or mid 20s when the political transition and roundtable talks began. He spent a brief time in Oxford as an aspiring scholar, something. Then he returned and he became a member of parliament in the newly elected parliament. So these people never had other job than being members of parliament. So he, to actually say that, the, you know, what the ideology of this party was is presupposing something that I'm not sure has ever been there. But so even this turn, you know, in the mid 90s was, you know, could have been as an opportunistic, you know, political move. I'm not sure it has been driven by, even at that point, any genuine ideological, you know, motivations.
But anyway, but now, when is the big change from a kind of liberalism, which to moderate conservative nationalism to this kind of authoritarian nationalism?
This is the third or second big turn, a complete U-turn into what he was standing for. I think the big difference between Orban and Kaczynski is that Orban does not believe for a moment in anything that he's propagating. I really think this regime does not even make the appearance to have a coherent ideological frame of what's happening. This is this whole sort of Christian conservative turn is not supported. First of all, it does not really have a public support, unlike Poland. Of course, you know, communism wasn't friendly, so, you know, to put it mildly, you know, towards religion. Hungary's have, of course, if you ask people in the census what their religion is, of course, they will tick a box, whatever, what their parents were. You know, people would be christening, you know, their children, but it's very, church attendance is very low. Again, it's difficult how you define how religious society is, but Hungary is not Poland. This sort of whole Christian ideology is not only not really supported by people. I've written a book on the democratic decline in Hungary, and I've been, you know, looking at census data, for example, what people do, what is their religious, you know, family values. It's not reflected in how people live in Hungary. So this is really not in sync with how people live. You know, there's rates of divorce and, you know, children born out of the wedlock. So this is nothing to do with not only with the people, but also I think, you know, Orban and his political allies don't believe this for a moment. They don't even need to make the appearance of taking this seriously. So none of this ideology actually is, it's a show. Everyone knows it's a show. I mean, let me give you one example. Orban this is something I've been writing about in my book. So Orban, you know, the first election night, he basically came up with this, and again, it's a constitutional concept of the national system of national cooperation, right? And this has been, they've issued a semi-constitutional document. It's something that their preamble of the constitution refers to. They never even talked about this after having adopted the constitution. They didn't even care to use this term, which is supposed to be a political, philosophical, you know, concept that explains what this regime is about. So none of this is taken serious, you know, is serious in any ways. I don't think Orban has any ideology. Orban is following a number of political. I think he is serious about, you know, but again, how can you be serious about this anti-immigration policy when you don't actually have immigrants coming to your country? Of course, the refugee crisis was one thing. That's, you know, that I, you know, that that has to be, you know, that.
But a sustained anti-immigration policy in the absence of immigrants.
So it's not, I mean, I would claim that this is a very, you know, I think this regime is only interested, Orban personally is only interested in power and, you know, sustaining, you know, as much of the flood of EU, you know, funds and, you know, money as much. I really don't think that, you know, there is any sincere ideological commitment to whatever they're saying. Of course, you have this sort of, you know, gender ideology. You have this conservative, you know, buzzwords around, which people do seem to be appreciative. What actually happens in Hungary is that, you know, Orban, due to his exceptional personal charisma, and I mean, this he is a genius. He is a political genius. He's an extremely charismatic person. You would have about one third of the voters who are genuinely, you know, worshiping him. And that's a standard core voting, you know, group for Orban. Whatever happens, these people vote for Orban. You have about You know, and then the rest would not. So you actually have, with a slightly gerrymandered, not outrageously gerrymandered system, you can, you know, with this and then many people not going to vote and this, you know, you can secure a regime that, you know, based on a, so this system is very well, has been very well developed. I mean, the legal, the constitutional foundations and the pillars of this system, how the regime has been cemented institutionally, is a masterpiece, I would have to say.
Okay, so let's talk about that masterpiece, yep. Because one of the oddities of Viktor Orban is that he doesn't get voted out.
Yep.
And in fact, the only question is whether he has two-thirds majority or doesn't have two-thirds majority. So to what extent are the elections real? And to what extent, I mean, to what extent is this an illiberal democracy? And to what extent is it not a democracy at all? It's just an authoritarian regime with optical elections. How real is the opportunity to vote out Viktor Orban?
That's a good question. I mean, again, it really just to what is democracy? So I don't want to, of course, I wouldn't want to be, you know, entangled in this sort of jungle of definitions that are out there in the literature. But also, how do you define, you know, what makes a democracy? That's why we have so many people coming up with so many, you know, a good and intellectually, you know, entertaining or challenging, you know, engaging definitions of what is democracy. That's why there's so much talk of that, because it's really not that easy to capture. I mean, I would not be a very, you know, obviously not being too formalistic about it, that, you know, outvoting, the potential to outvote the regime is what a democracy is. But again, that's the peculiarity, I guess, of this system, that first of all, I mean, there's, you know, it's been written very, the documents, the legal documents have been written fairly well, in the light of how important the, you know, the sort of the international regime for, you know, for this sort of multi-level constitutionalism doesn't really work. What we see that these international, you know, web of institutions may work to a certain degree when it comes to protection of, you know, civil liberties, like, you know, the European Court of Human Rights. If you have, you know, violations of specific, you know, fundamental rights, you can have remedy for that. But these institutions, including the EU, are not democracy watch, you know, watchdog organizations. They don't have competences for that. So what we even have to see, I mean, I think this is what the method, which Kim Lynch-Shepley described as a Franken state, this method worked very well for Orban's first few years. This is, you basically put together a piece of legislation where lawyers can argue, but look, I mean, every bit and piece of this particular legislation, on say electoral law, is taken from the German system, you know, an unquestionable democracy. This is taken from the American system. Come on, you can't get more democratic than that. This is exactly what we have in the British system. So you can bring, you know, a Frankenstein from legitimate, you know, and legally, you know, impeccable sort of mosaic pieces. So this could fool the Venice Commission, the Council of Europe's, you know, democracy watchdog organization for a while, because they got into this legal lawyering. Well, this is, you know, this is, oh, how can we say that this is anti-democratic? So it did work for a while, but we also have to say that for most cases, it is very difficult to point from the legal, the constitutional point of view, like, okay, this is what you do. I would say that, you know, there is gerrymandering in the system, but it's not outrageous. Even these elections this year, there was a modest, you know, optimism, even on my behalf, and people like, you know, Orban, it wasn't sure that he was actually going to win the election. We don't know what would have happened, he would have done if, you know, if this was not, no one thought that he was going to get a two-thirds, that he's going to win. I thought that he was going to win, you know, with all these extra, you know, bonuses in addition to gerrymandering, you know, voting rights given for, you know, external voting rights given to new citizens who've never lived in Hungary. You know, this is, you know, which give one or two mandates, a newly instituted reserved seats for national minorities, very few of them, and they're all sort of taken over by Orban. So, for example, the only preferential mandate that the German minority, the very small German minority, has in parliament is actually the guy who is the German representative, a member of Orban's party. So, you know, so you have these techniques, but he barely made the two-thirds. But, you know, he wasn't sure in April that he was actually going to win the election. Even they were pretty concerned. So there was a serious chance of actually of them potentially losing. Again, what would have happened then is another story. Even if, you know, if the elections wouldn't have been, you know, again, since the system is, you know, everyone is, you know, people are cemented, courts are packed, you know, it's unlikely that there would be corruption, you know, charges against Orban or any of his allies, because the prosecutor general is basically cemented into office for, you know, for forever, is a close political ally of him, you know, so it's not an authoritarian regime in this sense. You don't really see outrage, or very few outrageous things are going on. Some, like, you know, homelessness, and, you know, the law on homelessness and stuff. But this is not structurally there. That's the trick. That's area. It's very difficult to point. You need to have a 200-page, you know, report on how democracy is not working, which people obviously won't read and won't even, you know, may have time to, and the mental capacity to read and understand.
Okay, so one thing that a traditional authoritarian regime does that this regime does not do is repression of dissents and dissent and dissenters. And you're sitting here, we're in a lovely English country manor, talking about the Hungarian government, and later today or tomorrow, you'll fly back to Budapest and you're not going to get arrested and you're going to continue living your life as a professor and a think tank guy. Like, how does that work?
I'm not sure that is the case. I mean, it's not going to be physical oppression. So I'm going to be, no black car is going to wait for me to drive me not home, but to a, you know, a prison cell at the airport. That's true. But they have actually started, you know, shutting down universities and think tanks. So there is there's non-physical oppression of, you know, of annihilating independent media and, you know, research institutes and stuff. But yes, this works. I mean, one of the features is, as long as you do it in English, as long as you don't appear on national television, which of course you want, as long as you're not, you know, in the national, because, you know, Orban's only interested in internal politics. He's not, you know, that's not, of course there is a, he refers to this as a peacock dance. I think it's a very catching term. Like, you know, you dance around as a peacock, you know, courting, you know, saying, you know, double speech. This is what used to be. So he would be saying a different, you know, completely different things when he was in Brussels or when he was in Strasbourg or, you know, then in Budapest. Now it's no longer the case. He had actually turned policies, because now even in Brussels, he is the voice of this, you know, of this. And he's, you know, he has a large group of admirers in Brussels as well. Anyway, but so, you know, there's always this double, you know, but the focal point is always, you know, internal and domestic politics. As long as I don't talk about this and I don't broadcast a video on whatever on the largest national whatever website that would, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who would be potential non-fidus would see, and I would ignite, I don't know, an opposition movement. No one cares. I mean, you publish your book or an article in English, and, you know, you talk about this in thousands of, you know, kilometers from, you know, from Hungarian parliament. No one really cares. This has been, this is fairly standard. So you can do anything as long as you're not doing it in Hungarian, and, you know, because no one, you know.
And what happens if you try to do it in Hungarian? And if you try to do it locally, what's the worst thing that has happened to opposition figures?
No, I mean, not much. I mean, in a way, of course, it's also, I mean, this has also been the case in the late 80s, and, you know, in the softest communist regime and the softest period of, you know, publicity gives you some sort of a protection. So, you know, if you've beyond the point of, you know, they would probably, I mean, you would not face physical oppression. You would not be, you know, they probably would not even fire, you know, there would not even be a significant, you know, pressure on whatever a public university to fire you in case you were, you know, beyond the point of visibility of this being blatant. I think there's more, you know, self-censorship. We do see, you know, academic institutions, public universities, even private entities canceling pre-registered academic events, you know, completely harmless and ridiculously insignificant, you know, event talks on the Freemason movement just has recently been canceled by one of the private sort of alternative concert venues, you know, the Hungarian Academy of Sciences have cancelled conferences, you know, on gender, you know, completely, you know, nothing, you know, directly political and stuff. So I guess it would be self-censoring on behalf of institutions and people. But we've also seen is that the government tabloid media have been running pretty harsh attacks on people. So listing, the you know public intellectuals who have been in connection with the Soros Foundation or Central European universities, you know, you would have a list on this. You know, this is a pretty intimidating thing. You are also likely to get very harsh tax authority, tax investigations. That's pretty likely. That, you know, the next day. So you can, you know, you can have, of course, you can never prove this.
Of course.
So this is as harsh, but it can be pretty harsh. I mean, people don't, you know, this is a very intimidating and very stressful thing to see your name printed in political harassment, you know, and again, tax, a long run, you know, long lasting tax investigations taking up an incredible amount of time. This basically has killed a number of NGOs. That was even before. So there was a big scandal around, supposed interference with Norwegian fund. I mean, these are NGOs. These are like women's rights organizations and things like that. So there was extensive tax inquiries about, you know how this sphere works. You organize a conference, you need millions of bills for photocopying, whatever badges and things like that. Now, in order to have years of, you know, complying with the tax, you know, inquiry of how much and where is the contract where someone translated, you know, the English, the bilingual, whatever invitation note for a conference. Small NGOs who will have all the, you know, HR problems and all that, they can practically kill them just to be able to go to the tax authorities and have some innocent, you know, reports filed, you know, every fortnight. So these are the ways that this system works. But again, I think there's still the potential that, you know, there's going to be elections and it will just go, you know, the regime can be outvoted, which I don't, you know, practically it doesn't happen. And I think that's the important and interesting thing. And that's why I think Hungary is really off the scale. And any comparison with any other European or, you know, illiberal democracy is, you know, fails is that the national specifics, which is what makes this regime run. So, you know, for example, despite the very close sort of, you know, very, very little independent media, you know, presence there is, in the past years, we've seen an incredible explosion of investigative journalism in all these news portals. So every week we see these very long, very detailed, very specific coverage of how this and this billions of euros have been, you know, have been basically stolen by this and that, you know, government and Orban family, whatever, you know, enterprises. And there's no effect. There's nothing, no political consequences whatsoever. And this is, even living in this country, I fail to understand how this works. I fail to understand how this does not trigger a larger, you know, opposition. Of course, people, you know, are part of this regime, they make the deals. You cannot get around if you're doing any sort of business. Of course, you cannot get around this sort of this pyramid. When on the top you have an oligarch, and on the top of that pyramid you would have Orban. So, people have learned to coexist in this system, and Hungary is not doing particularly bad. Hungary could do much better. The healthcare system and the education system is falling apart. This is why, actually, to me, it's a mystery why people are not more concerned about, are not much more upset about, so even Fidesz voters are completely, there was a, you know, polls, even Fidesz voters are completely aware of the degree and the level of corruption that's going on. They just don't seem to care about it. Now, that's interesting to me. I'm not surprised why the ethical and moral aspect of corruption is not something that people would be upset in this sort of post-communist Europe, you know, values and things have been very, very different from Western Europe to begin with. But I think that the part of corruption is that you know that they're, you know, that they're building these nonsense, symbolic investments of football stadiums in every village. You know, you would have a village of 5,000 people and you would have a football stadium because this is Orban's, you know, policy of, you know, capable of having, I don't know, 50,000 people who would never feel that, you know, stadium. Whereas your hospital and your, you know, your school is, you know, is lacking, you know, there's no toilet paper in any hospital. So I don't see why people don't, you know, connect these dots.
So let's close with just a word about the state of the opposition. You have, as you say, even Fidesz voters see this. There's a very stifling propagandistic media environment. There is what we might call soft repression, but not hard repression. And there's an overlay of the EU and needing to be kind of part of a community that does expect certain democratic norms. What is the Hungarian opposition, and why isn't it more vibrant than it is?
That is the million-dollar euro question. I don't have an answer to that. I mean, I think this is the general apathy that's sort of everywhere in society. Is also, it kind of prevents a systematic, you know, opposition movement. Whether it's a I'm not even only talking about, you know, formalized, you know, parties and, you know, running in elections. We do have every now and then we have these sporadic protests. I mean, for example, when after the plans have been announced that they were going to shut down Central European University, the sort of private American Hungarian double accredited university originally founded by George Soros, 100,000 people went out on the street. This is a big deal. We're talking about a country of 10 million people. You know, knew what I would not have expected that, you know, and then nothing happened. And there were, for a couple of days, there were some people out there. We have similar issues. Again, universities being sold, and no one goes out on the streets. So there are political parties that some have been known to have been bought and funded and sort of, you know, by Fidesz. So they're a scam. You know, they're fake opposition parties. Some I don't deny they're completely... Again, it cannot be easy to operate in a parliament that basically your rights as a member of parliament are extremely limited. You're being, you know, I'll just give you one example. A member of parliament, okay, so one of the first things the Orbán have done in 2010 is that they removed the EU flag from parliament. Okay, why would you have that? So you would, every now and then you would have members of parliament hanging the EU flag from their windows in, you know, in their offices in parliament. Now that would cost them a 1 month salary, right? As a disciplinary measure on behalf of the speaker, you know, and these kind of things. I mean, it's very, you know, it can be a frustrating and, you know, thing to work in a parliament like that. But basically parliamentary opposition is, I don't know. I mean, it's instead of, you know, you have these, you know, talks, it should be a unified, you know, candidate. I'll give you one last example. There's going to be local elections next year. So Budapest has always been sort of a liberal stronghold or whatever, opposition stronghold. Fidesz has the least support in Budapest. There's some rich districts, you know, but apart from that. So Budapest is generally not a Fidesz supporter. I dare to say there's not even going to be an opposition candidate next year to run for mayor in Budapest. So Fidesz is not only going to win, but even going to win without a fight. I don't have an answer for that. I do see that there are some parties that are trolls that are actually, you know, fake parties funded by Fidesz to prevent a coalition of opposition parties. But it's the same. It's, you know, my research institute is going to be shut down. It's a public institution. I'm not doing anything. I've written a book on Orbán, but I'm also incapacitated somehow psychologically, mentally, emotionally to do anything. There's no unions. We're not doing anything. We're just there as, you know, as a game and, you know, in front of a hunter's gun, and we know that the gun is pointed at us and we're not doing anything. And honestly, I don't know why.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Academic Exchange, which hosted the conference at Wilton Park in the UK, where Pop and I caught up. Please take a minute to share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a rating on whatever podcast distribution service you found us. That's how we meet new people and they meet us. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our audio engineer this week was me and my iPhone, which is why the audio quality was not wonderful. And I apologize for that, but I thought the conversation was interesting enough to be worth suboptimal recording quality. Our music is, as ever, performed by the one, the only, the Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.